When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Aaron Sagers, and this is Talking Strange.
Hey there, spooky nerds, and welcome to Talking Strange, the paranormal pop culture show. I am your host, journalist, author, and researcher of weird things, Aaron Sagers, also from 28 Days Haunted on Netflix, Paranormal Caught on Camera on Travel Channel, and the Max streaming service. And currently, we are in the midst of our seventh season. Now, today, I'm very excited about the guest I'm bringing on, because not only am I a fan of his work, I have become an admirer of his work within the realms of the weird, the UFO, UAP realms, because of his podcast. His name is Dave Foley, and we know him from Kids in the Hall, A Bug's Life, News Radio, Hot in Cleveland, and the latest season of Fargo, which I also dug a lot. And he's also one half of Really with Tom and Dave, and that is with Tom Wheeler. And Dave Foley, thanks for joining me today, my friend.
Well, hey, Aaron, thanks for having me. I'm pleased to be with you.
Yeah.
Virtually.
Well, I guess last time we did this, I was with you and Tom on your podcast, which, you know, I have to say was one of my favorite podcasts, one of my favorite interviews to do, because it was thoughtful. It didn't feel like we were on the clock. It was just such an enjoyable experience. Is that kind of by design, that it's just sort of let the conversation go where it will, and you know, and just have fun with it? Or yeah,
definitely. I mean, I'm glad you felt that way about it. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I mean, that's the thing. We sort of came into it thinking, Tom and I felt like, well, we are definitely not experts on anything. You know, maybe the things we do for a living, we're more expert at. But definitely, you know, things with the paranormal and in our case, mostly it's been UFOs that we've been talking about, but that we wanted to just be able to learn from people that come on the podcast, and also kind of present things in a way that people who aren't steeped in all the lore and all of the, you know, who haven't got a full roster of all the players can follow along to. So we're, you know, trying to be like an entry point for people, a non-threatening entry point, I guess.
I think that's refreshing, because sometimes when you talk to people that are, as you said, sort of experts themselves doing the interviewing, or perhaps they perceive themselves to be, they're overlooking some of the things that might seem like obvious questions, but it's still worth going into, still worth asking that question, a recap, but also find out what you as a guest think about the quote unquote obvious question.
Yeah. And I know sometimes as we go along, it gets, we have to remind ourselves to do that more, you know, because as we become bigger and bigger, you know, UFO nerds by doing the podcast, you know, again, I started out that way, but Tom's, I'm the one, I sucked Tom into it. So now, you know, so it is that thing where you throw names around and you realize, oh my God, we really have to say who that person is, you know, and why that person is interesting or important when the name comes up.
Yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but what was the relationship with Tom, and how did you then convince him to do this show?
Well, we've been friends for over 20 years, I guess about 22, 23 years. I forget now, at least that long. Probably a little longer, I guess. Since around 2000, we've been friends, I think. And we met through our wives, who were in a play together in Los Angeles. And we've just, you know, the four of us just spent a lot of time together. And then over the years, you know, Tom's a great, he's a novelist and a screenwriter and a showrunner. So we, you know, so we're showbiz buddies as well as actual friends. And so, and I guess, you know, when I started, seriously looking at the UFO phenomena, or, you know, or UAP, if it makes people more comfortable. And then I started talking about it publicly, and that kind of spiraled, or not spiral, I guess, or snowballed, I guess, is a better term. Sometimes it feels like a spiral, into me getting more and more, like, basically, I just started, I saw a movie by James Fox, the Out of the Blue documentary, which really kind of got me thinking, wow, this is something I've always been curious about and paid attention to off and on over my life. And then I thought, wow, this is actually something really serious. And these are very serious people that are involved in this with really interesting stories and a lot of facts. And I thought, well, I should start talking about it. And then oddly enough, I became friends with Jeremy Corbell. And then even more oddly, Jeremy, I wound up having an experience together of a UFO. And I started talking about that online, and when Tom heard about that, he sort of called me up and said, so what's going on with this UFO thing? And so I never discussed it with him, and I told him a little bit, and we decided to have a dinner, had dinner with Tom and his wife, and told him sort of what was going on back, I guess, several years ago now, about 3 years ago, I guess now. And he started looking into it, and then he got sucked into the rabbit hole and then called me up and said, you know, maybe we should do a podcast. Our wives were suggesting it as well. And so we started the podcast, and that's kind of how we wound up in it. Tom, who initially wasn't really that interested, but he had his own paranormal experiences growing up with a haunting that he experienced, and a possible UFO incident when he was a little kid.
Yeah, Tom is, I think, if I recall, he's also a bit of like a comic book nerd, as am I. And
oh yes, very much. Worlds.
And I think I shared with you on your show that it was the comic book stuff, as well as devouring things like the In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy and the Mysteries of the Unknown book series, things like that. What was sort of your origin before you had your experience, which we'll get into, but what was your origin of interest? Did it begin as a little kid?
Well, it began very, when I was very young. Again, I think in like 1971, there was this TV series called UFO by Gerry Anderson, who did all the Marionation series back in the 60s and early 70s. He also did Space 1999, was probably his biggest budget show. UFO was on TV when I was a little kid, and I watched that, and that kind of gave me, that's where I learned the term UFO and was first interested in it. And there was also a show around a little after that called Invaders with Roy Thinnes.
Okay.
Excuse me. And so those sort of put the awareness in my head initially. And then, of course, watching In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, who I was a big Star Trek fan. So that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. This experience that you had, was it January 2022?
It was, January 11th. And where are we at? 24 now? 22 or 20? I guess it was 22. I think it was 22. Yeah.
So a lot has been written about this. And as I said, I hate to ask the obvious question, since you've already been quoted many times about it and you tweeted about it at the time. Yeah,
but I haven't talked about it on your podcast.
That's right. And I did not, I missed the part where Jeremy was with you. So just kind of briefly explain what it was, and then I guess also the feeling of being this person that was fascinated by this, but had not had that experience yet. I can kind of relate to that, because when you do have that experience, it kind of unlocks a whole new level in your brain. So talk a little bit about both the experience and how you felt afterwards.
Well, I guess I should say, like Jeremy and I became friends just because I figured, you know, as lack of a better term, a public figure talking about UFOs being a serious thing. And I talked about it. I was on Joe Rogan's podcast for another podcast I was doing at the time. And I sucked Joe Rogan back into UFO world on that podcast by talking about things like Jeremy Corbell's movie about Bob Lazar called, what was it called? Area 51, Bob Lazar and Flying Saucers. I think I got the title right.
I think it's something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and that sort of sucked Joe back into it. And so then Jeremy reached out and said thanks, and we became friends through that. And pardon me. But, you know, Jeremy's dedicated his life to the subject, researching it and getting information out to the public and making documentaries. But he had never experienced anything either. One night I was just visiting Jeremy. We were out walking his dog and walking through these sort of orange groves in a valley. And it was, January, so it was dark early. And I remember I was like looking, it was a beautiful clear night, and I was looking at all the commercial air traffic off in the distance and going, you know, and said to Jeremy, you know, tonight would be a really good night to see something. And less than a minute later, Jeremy goes, Dave, turn around. And I turn around, and there's this back where I was just watching the commercial traffic. There's suddenly this glowing orangey gold thing that's about 10 times bigger than anything else over there. And we watch that slowly circle this valley we're in until it's basically right in front of us. I guess it wasn't that slow because it's a big valley, and it got there in, you know, less than a minute. So it came around the valley until it was hanging right in front of us. Probably not more than a couple hundred yards away, I think. And it just sort of hung there for at least a minute so that we could get a good look. And then it went off behind the mountains. And the weird thing was that neither of us had any response for this whole thing, except that at one point, Jeremy goes, I'm not even going to take a picture, out loud, which is a weird thing to say for a guy who practices getting his camera ready to take pictures of UFOs, you know. So I felt like, and it almost felt like, well, I don't think he's talking to me, you know, necessarily. So none of us, we had no elevated emotion, no excitement, nothing. Just, we were both just completely quiet and watching this thing for the duration of the event. And if anyone out there knows Jeremy, you know that Jeremy not talking for several minutes is a rare, rare occurrence. And it wasn't until it went behind the mountains that Jeremy just went, dude, that was a UFO. And I go, yeah, I think that was a UFO, you know. And then we went back to his place and kind of debriefed each other on it. And Jeremy did like a quick sort of search for things it might have been, and nothing came up. And it was just this, and again, even to this day, when I talk about it, there's a weird absence of emotion in it. There's no excitement connected to it. In fact, it's, you know, as I said, like, we didn't take pictures. The next day I did like a quick drawing of it on my iPad, which was also weird because I can't draw. But somehow I opened up this app, was able to find all the tools I need, an app I'd never used before. I downloaded without ever opening it. Was able to find out all the tools I needed, all the, pens and brushes and effects to draw basically exactly what we saw. And I can't draw anything. And so I drew it in about 15 minutes and at one point just went, okay, I think that's done, and sent it to Jeremy. And he said, is this what we saw? And he immediately went, yeah, that's exactly what we saw. So that was, again, another weird thing that it felt like, I don't, like, if I tried to draw it again now, I don't think I'd be able to. Yeah, so it was, Oh no, I was just gonna say. So we shared this thing, and it's like, and as I said, Jeremy hates the woo aspects of UFOs, as people call it. You know, he hates that sort of the consciousness stuff, because he's a nuts and bolts guy. He just wants the data and the you know, and something that he can, you know, that he can look at and, you know, and hold on to and say this is solidly real. So all of that. So suddenly, you know, when we both behave in a way that doesn't make any sense. I mean, I know he's does not like that at all about the experience. But
especially because there are so many people that have that believe that they have some sort of relationship with these things, or that they can talk to them and call them forward and see the lights in the sky as a result. And that's the woo factor. But but it seems to be such a theme. It's sort of the parallel I draw are the Bigfoot researchers that are like the hardcore, like it's a bipedal hominid, a relic hominid. It's an actual creature that here's all the reasons why it could exist in nature without being easily discovered, versus it's a elemental spiritual kind of entity moving through dimensions, you know, and those are the woo people. And I'm kind of the perspective of why not both? I mean, why, as humans, we just need to put these things in boxes, but we don't have hard explanations for them. So why not potentially both?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of entries to this mindset, but for me, coming into it through the UFO phenomena and through my own that experience, your certitude about almost everything gets shattered. You know, I've been a smug atheist, materialist, reductionist my entire sort of since probably like around 12 years old. I was a precocious kid, and to suddenly have to sort of go, well, okay, you know, this opens you up to thinking, well, a lot of other things I've really not been bothering to think about might have more credence than I thought, you know. And then, you know, Sasquatch is something that I've, you know, kind of snickered at and not taken seriously. And now I go, well, all right, well, if, you know, weird creatures are showing up on Skinwalker Ranch, and I think those people are credible and sensible people that are reporting this stuff, then I got to open that aperture a little more.
I'll tell you what, like on the Bigfoot side, having conversations with guys like Dr. Jeff Meldrum, a legit academic who is researching this stuff, and other people kind of are learning about Jane Goodall, who says that she thinks there is something out there. These people that are way smarter than me, when they talk about this, it becomes very convincing in my mind. But is there any kind of really hard limit that you still kind of bump up against where you're just like, I don't know, I just can't get on board with that one?
I keep thinking there is, and then it keeps getting knocked out of me. You know, it's things like, I mean, things like those, the Peruvian mummies. You know, like that's one where I, you know, for people that, yeah, I'm probably people when you're listening to, you know what the Peruvian mummies are, you know, and that's one where I went, okay, I don't have to take that seriously, do I? And then of course all these studies are coming out saying, yeah, you probably might want to take this seriously. These things aren't manufactured. They aren't, you know, they don't seem to be human, and they seem to have, you know, there seems to be some argument that they're real.
I have mine that I bump up against, but when I do, I think sort of similar to you, much like I think hubris, you know, is a path to downfall. It's sort of pretentiousness in this era of superiority. Also, like when you hold on to that, you're just limiting yourself and potentially kind of setting your own downfall, because the universe has a way of like kind of smacking you around sometimes when you operate that way. Yeah. Do you, I was, I can't say that I recall every single Kids in the Hall sketch, but
well, I can give you time to review them if you like.
I mean, I do distinctly remember loving them, and the ones that I did love, and the one of the ones that I have loved for many years, I guess multiple decades, showing both of our ages, is the Our Extraterrestrials Doll.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Where you play this host that could be almost Rod Serling-esque or Leonard Nimoy-esque, and it's about the mundane, banal existence of extraterrestrials. Was that something that came about because of your interest? Was that a sketch that you pitched, or and did you talk about this kind of material with the guys when you were doing the show and the sketches before the show?
You know, I don't think I ever talked about UFOs seriously with any of the guys in those days. Definitely was something I had an interest in, and I would watch, you know, whatever specials would show up or on TV. Most of them are usually pretty terribly done. But then there were some ones that I took seriously. Like, I remember George Knapp's, Best Evidence series that was probably the one that got, I took the most seriously back then. And definitely, you know, In Search Of, and I think, you know, and you know, it had other levels. Part of it was like, I always had this sense that, you know, I was interested in UFOs, but I always felt like everything always turns out to be dull. You know, I'm always thinking something is nothing. I always kept thinking, nothing interesting is ever really going to happen in my lifetime. You know, it was my feeling about things. So that's kind of what inspired that, you know, that sketch. I just thought it was a funny take.
It was, I mean, but it was also, it was authentic as far as a little spooky nerd back then, or slightly younger spooky nerd. When you watch those things and you're like, oh, the person that wrote this gets it. Not just that it's a bit that they're playing off of, but there's this understanding of the overall genre behind it, which always makes it funnier. And people can check that one out, out there on YouTube and other places, in legal ways. I mean, you mentioned Joe Rogan. Obviously you guys did news radio together, and, you know, I worked at the Sci-Fi Network, at one point when he had a show overlapping with it, where he was kind of dipping into that stuff. This must have been like, I don't know, 2011, 2012 or something like that.
Joe Questions Everything. Is
yeah,
that the show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is actually the one that put him off of UFOs for a while.
Right.
Which startled me when I called him up to tell him, like, it was one of the things I texted him the night before I was going to do his show. And I said, oh, by the way, you'll be excited to hear I'm deep into UFOs right now. And he texted back, it's all bullshit. I don't believe that those people are all crazy. And I went, what?
Was Baby Joe back on news radio? Did he, I mean, you were both babies, I guess, because it was, what, 1995 is when it premiered. So
yeah.
29 years ago, May 99 or May 95. So did you guys ever chat about that, or did that come up on?
We did talk about it. Yeah. Cause we both, I think we both believed that there was something real to the UFO phenomena. I mean, Joe believed stuff that I was pretty dismissive of. But I definitely thought the Phoenix Lights was a real incident, and that the explanation was bullshit, and, you know, and still is, you know, but I mean, we would defer on, we would differ on things like Joe was certain that the pyramids were built by aliens or with the help of aliens. And I didn't believe that, you know. I would say, well, I might believe that if there was like one electrical light in there, you know, one light bulb, and I might be tempted to believe it. But I just sort of, well, I think people can build pretty amazing things. And, you know, so we had disagreements about degree. But we both believe there was something real going on, and that there, you know, that there's something happening. You know, so that's, yeah, because it was like, I mean, back, yeah, what else was, Stephenville was much later, but what else? Shortly after that, I guess the Cometa report came out.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, 2003 or something like that.
Well, you know, news radio was, I went to school for journalism, and then I worked in newsrooms, and then I also worked in broadcast news a bit. And that was long before, you know, the paranormal stuff kind of kicked in as a profession. But on that show, you also worked with what I consider a comedic great, Phil Hartman, who we tragically lost too soon. Any kind of, I mean, this is just a very selfish question, but any kind of fond recollections about Phil, or, you know, from your perspective as a comedian, being in rooms with these, with other comedians that you feel like, wow, I'm really surrounded by greatness here. Have you, any experiences like that or any anecdotes?
Yeah. I'm lucky in that I've had that with, that's been most of my experience really. In a lot of ways, I mean, because certainly my fellow kids in the hall, I still think are some of the funniest guys in the world. But then, yeah, and then I was a big Phil Hartman fan. And in fact, when I was signed on to do news radio, they hadn't booked Phil yet on it. I knew they were reaching out and trying to talk Phil into doing it. And I kept saying to Paul Simpson, "You're never going to get Phil Hartman. You know, he's come on, you crazy. He's going to do something else." And then it turned out Phil really liked the show, and, you know, and so he did come on board. So I was thrilled, because I knew I'd met Phil like about a year before that, and we talked about how much fun it would be to do something together. But definitely doing news radio, like every week sitting down, you know, across the table from Phil Hartman and watch, you know, and listening to him do his first take of a script, and just, you know, it was just delightful, because, you know, I'd spent years watching him on Saturday Night Live, and, you know, Kevin McDonald always, and I always referred to him as having perfect pitch, you know, that he never, you know, he never misses a laugh that's in the script. If there's a laugh to be had, he'll get it. You know, he'll never, you know, we say he'll always come out with a full harvest. Mm-hmm. And so that was always really fun to watch. You know, and he was just a fun, very silly man, you know, in a lot of ways. He was an artist, so after Phil was gone, we would keep finding all these little drawings and doodles and sketches all over the set that Phil had done, you know, because he had done album covers for the band America and Pogo. He designed their album covers. You know, his brother was in the music industry, so he came into it with his brother. You know, what else? He told me, remember once he told me about being a roadie at the Roxy, I think it was. And he was working, I think it was the Roxy, or yeah, not the Whiskey, I think it was the Roxy. Yeah, he was like a roadie there, and Jimi Hendrix was playing in the Roxy. But his drummer's drum kit kept sliding forward on the stage, right? Every time he'd hit the kick drum. And so like his boss said, "Get out there and hold the drums in place." So he had to go out and sit on, crouch on the stage, holding the drum kit in place at the foot of, like, basically, like, it's not a big stage, the Roxy stage. He's basically crouching at the feet of Jimi Hendrix performing on the stage and holding the drum kit in place for the entire show. And that was like, you know, that was like one of his favorite showbiz memories.
Getting sweat upon by Jimi Hendrix, yeah. And the experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, he was a fun guy, you know. And, and you know, that news radio cast, I mean, we all hung out together, you know, a lot of times. I mean, we spent so much time together and hanging out after the shows. And,
well, you, and also on that show, you had Stephen Root, who we've seen do a diversity of roles, and recently in Barry, where he's able to strike that comedic pitch and then a very dramatic tone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see in my mind this correlation between that role and then Danish Graves on the most recent season of Fargo, which Absolutely. I think my favorite season of Fargo so far. And I really just loved this character of Danish Graves. And I was curious, like, do you kind of slip into that kind of dramatic role fairly easily? And do you think being a comedian kind of was able to make it a little bit easier for you to take on that kind of role? It feels like a character that was both in your wheelhouse, but so bizarrely out there.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. There's certainly a level of dark comedy to everything in
Sure.
Fargo, but it's definitely it's not frivolous about the violence and about some of the darker themes. But there's an undercurrent of humor to it. So I was comfortable with that part of it. And I'll say, since you liked it, I'll say, yeah, it was easy. But it was definitely a, you know, I, you know, it was a challenge in that, well, for two things. One is that I'm such a fan of the show and such a fan of the writing on the show that I didn't want to, you know, I kept thinking, oh God, I don't want to ruin the show that I love. So I really have to be good. And I also thought, oh, I have all these scenes with Jennifer Jason Leigh. That's going to be hard because she's so good. I got to make sure I stay in those scenes and, you know, that I don't let her down, you know, and or that I don't just get cut out of them. That I'll just be an off-camera voice because they'll just want to stay on Jennifer for everything. So that was, you know, I was nervous about doing it, and so I'm really happy that people liked what I did, you know.
Did the character arrive pretty fully formed with all of the affectations, the eye patch, the wearing white, everything, or how much was that developed once you came on board?
Well, the eye patch was in the script. That was Noah Hawley, which he never explained. All he said in the stage directions, it says the result of a childhood injury. And that's all, you know. And I kept thinking, oh, in later scripts, we'll find out what happened. No one didn't care about it. At one point, I said, oh, is the eye patch symbolic? I mean, I said, is the eye patch like symbolic of his ability to turn a blind eye to the evil that he does as part of his job for Lorraine? And he went, no, I just like it, you know. So I tried to find some meaning in it, but it was just he liked the look of it. And it turned out, you know, it was a, you know, as an actor, it was a nice tool because it definitely changes the way you look, changes the way you carry yourself, you know. And for me, I use my eyes fairly extensively when I work, and this was, you know, putting it all into one eye is interesting.
I know you can't really approach a role by thinking of the character as a villain, but you know, with some distance from it now, how do you reflect back on Danish Graves? And I mean, because he does bad things, but he also seems to have this baked in sense of honor that guides his actions, or at least allows him to justify his actions. So how do you look at him with a little
Yeah.
bit of distance?
Yeah, well, he's definitely does evil things, and for his boss Lorraine, who he just absolutely admires and wants to be, you know, he wants to be her. And I think, but the other problem is he's a guy with nothing, with no life outside of that relationship, really. So it's like, so you know, the closest thing he has to family is her family, and he's not really a part of it. So I think that's where his moral thread gets picked up, or discovered, when suddenly he's being asked to do terrible things to someone he considers a part of the family, you know, and that's where it starts to crumble for him, and he starts to think, this is wrong. This We can't do this, you know.
Yeah.
I think he's a guy who really wants to belong somewhere and wants a family. And he's decided that these people who don't feel that way about him, you know, are going to be that family. Although as it goes along, though, there was a nice thing where Jennifer actually added in moments of actual affection between Danish and Lorraine, because she said, well, we should show that they really do like each other and that they are a team, you know.
Yeah.
So there was a nice, she kind of added in a nice moment where, you know, where she like takes Danish by the arm, you know, and I think like sort of straightens his lapel as she's sending him off to destroy John Hamm's character.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the sense of this is the best he's got as far as family and community, if I recall, is pretty much established in the very first scene, the Christmas card scene with him, where he tries, he's trying to be in there, but is very much dismissed from.
Yes.
The show. Yeah. And before we wind down, I feel like as a Kids in the Hall fan, I was both excited and like so many people, a little bit concerned when we had the revival just, is it 2 years ago now that it came out?
Yeah, it's 2 years ago. Yeah.
So, and I know at the time that Doomsday DJ was arguably, all due respect to your cohorts, because it was such a great return, but Doomsday DJ seems to be the one that was talked about the most out of those sketches. I've thought a lot about it, weirdly enough, because I think it kind of taps into a moment that we're experiencing. Are you still getting responses on Doomsday DJ, and what do you attribute this popularity of this very depressing and strange sketch?
Yeah, I thought, you know, definitely it was definitely, I mean, I've never had, you know, a sketch that I've did interviews just about that sketch with like, I think like Entertainment Weekly or, you know, would, you know, Vulture, you know, wanted to talk about that sketch. Which was surprising to me because it was one of the things when I wrote it, I thought, well, okay, this is a sort of weird thing that I like, and I don't know if anyone else will really get it. And it has like a performance element to it that I love that transition. And so, it, you know, but I thought it might be a little bit too weird or too maybe gentle a piece in a way. You know, I remember doing it for the other Kids in the Hall, and they all loved it right away, which was nice. And then, even when we were shooting it, I kept, you know, because, you know, it took forever to shoot. We shot so much coverage, and, you know, and I kept thinking, oh, this is never going to work. What the hell am I doing? And then the response to it, I guess it was that, you know, coming out of, we shot it during COVID. The height of COVID, and it was also on the tail end of the Trump administration, which was its own nightmare for me, and for the world, but me particularly.
Yeah. I think we can say for the world.
Yeah. I think there's just that sense of all the norms and all of our assuredness that, you know, that life is going to progress in a way that you can predict just went out the window at that point, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, that we had this man who was just kind of destroying every sort of norm that we relied on in Western culture to keep democracy running. And then we got hit with, you know, with a pandemic with this guy in charge. And I think, you know, then everyone got locked in and, you know, you know, like the Kids in the Hall, we had to shut down production for almost a year. You know, and we were all sort of forced to think about things and communicate through things like Zoom. And this is now a part of our culture that is along with, sidewalk cabanas outside of restaurants are two things that I think are never going to go away. And I guess they're both good things, you know, that came out of it. So, I guess it just tapped into that feeling that everyone had.
Yeah.
But I was certainly startled by the response to it.
It's, it was actually a fellow, UFO nerd, John Tenney. I know you,
yes, I follow John.
And, yeah. when we were kind of watching the new episodes, he was like, you're going to need to see this one soon. Like jump right into this one. And kind of hit a point for both of us. Now, before I let you go, we are both heading to Northern Fan Con in Prince George, British Columbia, Canada, for May 3rd to 5th, Star Wars day and weekend.
Yes.
And first off, have you any tips on Prince George? Have you been up there before?
I've never been there. We almost moved there when I was a kid. When I was, I think, early teens, I think my dad had a job offer to go up to Prince George. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, that sounds kind of exciting. Sounds like, you know, oh, wait, up in the woods, up in, you know, in the mountains, in the woods. That sounds like an interesting way to live. I'm sure it's not as rugged as I think it is, or thought it was as a kid, but as exposed, we didn't wind up going up there, but I've never been. I'm looking forward to seeing the town.
I am as well. I've actually heard that it is a good spot for sky watching, and there's also supposedly this old haunted town nearby as well.
Let's go.
Yeah, I think we should make a little road trip.
That'd be fun.
What are some of the favorite parts about doing these fan conventions and comic cons? I mean, obviously you get to interact with a lot of folks, but is there any kind of special joy for it with you?
Definitely just hearing, you know, people's stories about, you know, whatever piece of work I did that affected them, that meant something to them, is always nice. I think that the thing that I really like the most are you see a lot of like autistic kids and autistic adults too at these fan fests. And I think those are some of my favorite interactions.
Yeah.
Like, same. Just really, really sweet, wonderful people. And that it's just such a, you know, that these events, it's not even just me, but that these events are, such a sort of uplifting and positive part of their lives, you know, and to get a chance to talk to them often is, and sometimes getting little gifts from them, which is really nice.
Yeah. The fan culture, kind of the embrace of, I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know that I'm smart enough to quite explain it, but seeing a lot of the fans that are on the spectrum gravitate to this fan culture. I think it's, because it's a welcoming community, but it's also like all of us, the fandom allows us escapism, you know, and that I think hits a thread for them as well. Do you find that there is like, what are some of the random kind of projects that come up at these events where, like, I didn't know anyone was still talking about, I don't know, a role in Sky High, you know, from the early 2000s? Or are there any kind of just deep cuts that really throw you off a little bit?
I've had definitely people, somebody showed up with a screen capture from a movie I did called Postal.
Okay.
In which I was naked. So that was surprising. They wanted me, you know, to sign that. What else is this? I guess also now, now there's the series, the TV series Fallout is out now. So there'll be some people who are really surprised to find out that I was the voice of Yes Man in the Fallout New Vegas game. So that's one of the, you know, one of the things where I, you know, did it years and years ago and didn't think about it for a long time.
I guess with Flick, with A Bug's Life, do kids gravitate to you, or is there still like a disconnect between the voice and Flick as a character?
It's weird, because usually it's the parents explaining, he's the voice of Flick, you like Flick, and then I'll do a line from the movie and they'll look very confused, you know, it'll be like you know, that wait a minute, that voice is a person's voice, you know. Yeah. There's a weird kind of a disconnect to it with kids. You know, so that's even, you know, yeah, I always enjoyed, you know, I used to, you know, enjoy going to Disneyland. And I remember once we're meeting the guy dressed up as Flick and standing behind him and just shouting lines from the movie, and he would act them out for kids in the park. And it was just, that was fun.
Yeah. That's cool. I look forward to seeing and hearing about some of the roles that people bring up to you at Northern FanCon coming up, like I said, May 3rd to 5th.
And yeah, I think my penis has its own IMDb page at this point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that'll lead to some, I guess, interesting photo ops, autograph experiences.
Yeah.
and for anyone out there that can make their way up to Prince George, it's tickets still available at fancon.ca May 3rd to 5th. And Dave, just overall, I mean, what are the ways that people can show up, support you, not just at Northern FanCon, but across the board and keep up with everything you're doing?
Well, I guess you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. We also have Instagram accounts for the Really podcast, Really with Tom and Dave, and we're also on YouTube, YouTube and all your podcasting platforms. And what else? I'm trying to think. Anything else? That's it. That and just sort of waving, say hi when you pass me in the street. It's always nice. Yeah.
I do really encourage people to check out Really with Tom and Dave, because it is such a enjoyable experience and accessible. It's not just an insidery podcast about strange phenomena. So I like that. And no. I suspect you'll get, I'm suspecting you'll get some sort of Danish Graves cosplay up in Northern FanCon or at these upcoming events. Have you seen this yet?
I haven't yet, but it's, I gotta say, I really am, again, much like the Doomsday DJ, I've been getting such great comments and warm response to Danish Graves since the show's aired. That's very gratifying, because people seem to really like that character, and so I'm pretty happy about that. A lot of people, yeah, it's weird to, you know, I would say I can always gauge gauge what level of celebrity I'm at by the grocery store, you know, and I was definitely went from being, you know, a few polite people stopping to say hello to about like 10 or 15 people. So,
except like probably in New York where nobody cares or says anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least not at my C town anyhow.
Not so much at my grocery store. Yeah. So it's, but definitely in the neighborhood, every once in a while, there'll be people going, "Hey, what are you doing here?" You know, because up in Inwood, they don't expect to see me.
Well, I'm going to let you go, but I just got some footage I saw on the show that I filmed for that was shot like literally down the street from me of some sort of strange light in the sky. Ryan Sprague of Somewhere in the Skies posted about it as well. And then there was just something over, I think, LaGuardia Airport, like, you know.
Yeah, that's that sort of tubular thing. Yeah. I've only seen the clips on Instagram. I don't really know much about any follow up on it.
Well, you know, supposedly 50 years ago, John Lennon, you know, wrote about seeing a UFOs
over New York. Yeah,
and
nobody told me there'd be days like these. It's in right. There. And he drew the UFO on Walls and Bridges, his album, right.
And the liner notes. Yeah, and it's so I don't know. What do you think? You think we've got stuff? I mean, L.A. has plenty of stories, but you think we've got some activity over New York?
Well, there have been some pretty interesting UFO stories in New York. I mean, there was the story of a diplomat and his security team driving through New York and seeing a woman levitated out of a building into a UFO. A lot of other people saw that. And that was, yeah, there's a woman who was like, yeah, basically passed through right through the walls of her high rise apartment building and was abducted.
I don't know that I know that story.
Yeah. It's a pretty weird story. Yeah. And I think the diplomat recently went public. It was somebody, it was like an anonymous story for decades, I think. But yeah, it was a UN diplomat.
Yeah, and that's the thing.
With his security team.
New York City is a capital of culture, cuisine, fashion, finance.
Yeah.
The UN.
Yeah. And did the thing that happened in your neighborhood, did you see it?
I remember, I didn't see it myself, but I remember when it happened and the footage that came through. I was like, I literally know that bar, and that is like not even a 3-minute walk from where I live.
Yeah.
And then there's that moment of slight disappointment that, like, of course it happened right outside my building and I didn't see it.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
I had to hear about it afterwards. But it's still pretty cool. And, you know, it makes sense to me that there might be stuff checking out New York City.
Yeah. Well, it seems, well, as I said, most sightings occur where most people are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's the main correlation is where the most people are is, you know, the whole idea that it always happens in the woods to people in, you know, in their, you know, their RVs.
Yeah.
You know, isn't true. It's mostly over major cities is where most of the sightings are.
Well, I look forward to chatting more about all things weird and about your career at Northern FanCon a couple days from now. And meanwhile, Dave, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm looking forward to seeing you in a few days' time.
I know. It's been a blast. Well, my guest has been Dave Foley. This has been Talking Strange. I have been and continue to be Aaron Sagers. And until next time, be kind, stay spooky, and keep it weird.
Talking Strange is a part of the Den of Geek Network, available wherever you listen to other podcasts. If you like what we're doing, share Talking Strange with your friends and fellow spooky nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and leave a nice review. If you have a strange or paranormal story you would like to share with us, please email talkingstrange@denofgeek.com for a chance to have it read on a future episode. For video episodes of Talking Strange, check out twitch.tv/denofgeektv and youtube.com/denofgeekus. And please follow @talkstrangepod on Twitter and @AaronSagers on Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon for more paranormal pop culture content.